She comes out with a big grin on her face and just says, you just won the Nobel Prize. And I said, no, I didn't. And she said, yes, you did. I have 200 text messages from our friends. And I literally said, you know, my friends would spoof me, but they're not that coordinated. There's no way 200 of them got together at 6 o'clock in the morning to text me.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. I have to admit, I was pretty nervous for this one. My guest for this episode is a brilliant scientist. So brilliant, in fact, that he just won the Nobel Prize in Medicine. And while I'm used to chatting with incredibly smart and interesting people, I am no scientist. Embarrassingly, I took botany as my lab science requirement in college because I heard it was the easiest option, and no shade to any of my botanist listeners. But I had nothing to worry about. Fred Ramstall is funny and down to earth. He's also unusually good at translating complex science in a way that is understandable and makes you lean in. So please welcome Fred Ramstall, our very first Nobel laureate, to The Other 80. So great to have you on the show. We are sitting here on the 19th floor of a hotel in Taipei, which is not where I thought I'd be interviewing you. Also, I'm a little intimidated because my guest, who you'll hear from in a minute, just won the Nobel Prize in Medicine, which is amazing. So to start with, what's important to know about you beyond the science?
It's important to know about me besides the science. I guess I would say I'm a huge dog lover. My wife and I do not have children, so we have dogs instead, so they sleep on my shoulders most evenings. I have a 14-year-old Gordon Setter who is half deaf, half blind with congestive heart failure, but he doesn't know he has any of those problems. He has a great life. He is the model for how we should all age. And then I have a 13-year-old husky something rescue, not sure what she is kind of thing, who is quite adorable.
Oh, that's amazing. You told a very funny story in one of the interviews I listened to, which was getting the call and not believing that you
won. It's worse than that. So there's really only one phone call that I know of that anyone gets between midnight and 2 a.m.
That's not a family member.
That's good.
Right.
It's always somebody needs bail, somebody has died, you know, something like that, right? There's one phone call in that I can think of that's good. I missed it. There's only 1,000 people ever who have gotten this prize. I missed the phone call because I was off in the mountains with my dogs in the snow east of Yellowstone, off grid, which is very common for me. We were at the end of a 3.5-week camping trip. Old dogs, we don't backpack anymore. They're too old. They can't hang out backpacking. So we just camp. We drive through some little town on the north end of Yellowstone and Gardner, I believe. And my wife's phone basically blows up. And at about the same time, I pull over to let the dogs go out and go pee and go run around a little bit. And I hear her scream, my God, in the truck. And
which, again, could be something bad.
Well, it could be. We're in bear territory. But I'm like, well, there's no bears here. What's going on? She comes out with a big grin on her face and just says, you just won the Nobel Prize. And I said, no, I didn't. And she said, yes, you did. I have 200 text messages from our friends. And I literally said, you know, my friends would spoof me, but they're not that coordinated. There's no way 200 of them got together at 6 o'clock in the morning to text me. And so then I called one of my fellow laureates, a woman named Mary Brunko, who I've known for a long time. She and I did the work together at a little company in Seattle area. And I called her. And of course, she was shocked, et cetera. And then I began to call friends and people who had colleagues who had sent me stuff. So I spent the whole rest of the day or afternoon or evening calling people. And finally, at some point, this was a Monday, I realized we should go get some food. So we're in Livingston, Montana, 10,000 maybe. And so we just go to the nearest place we can find, which is an Irish pub. And we sit at the bar while Monday Night Football is playing in the background.
Oh, no, you see your photo.
And it's, this is Livingston, Montana. They don't care. So this place is packed. And I'm just looking at my wife, Laura, and saying, no one in the world, no one in this bar has any idea what just happened to me in my life. It was totally crazy. Oh. So no, I did not see my phone. I have yet to see an interview I've given. I have yet to see the cover of the New York Times. I have yet to see any of the stories or hear any of the interviews that are written about me because I really don't like listening to my voice or seeing my picture. So okay, I'm trying
well,
to avoid
good
it.
To know for this podcast.
I'm not going to listen to this podcast at the end of the day either. So,
oh, dear. Okay. I got over that, by the way. It's possible to get over it. It's probably been a whirlwind of a few months. And I'm just wondering, has anything shifted for you in the way you look at your role, in the way you think about the future of your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had ironically tried to retire about 18 months ago. So I had actually left my day job. I work for a small biotech that I helped found. I left that job and I was on the scientific advisory board for that company, still am. So then this happens, which as everyone who knows me now realizes has completely screwed up my retirement. So aside from the fact that I have, as of today, 44 plane trips this year, which is a lot even for me, it has made me rethink a role. I have a voice now that people actually pay attention to. We are sitting here. 6 months ago, you and I would not be doing this.
By the way, you don't have a lot of podcast episodes out there because we checked.
I have zero. I have no
this
social.
This is the first one?
I think so.
Oh, goodness.
I think so. I have no social media presence because I was never on social media.
Yeah.
So I get it. I understand that. I'm not – there's no complaint there in the slightest bit. But people actually pay attention to what I say now, which was not true 6 months ago. And so what do you do with that? And so it's not like I'm going to take a job and go back into the lab and restart the research that I was working on. There are actually people who are far more talented than I am who are doing that already. They don't need me to do that. That's working quite well. But I can talk about science writ large. I can talk about the status of science in the United States, certainly biomedical science. I can talk about how innovation occurs and gets translated into something useful at the end of the day. So there are other ways I think that I can use this newfound voice that might be impactful in a different way from the science that I actually did before.
That's a great way to use that platform.
I'm still figuring out what it's going to look like, to be honest, but
more time in Montana for sure,
absolutely.
No matter what.
Absolutely.
Let's start digging into your science. I prefaced this conversation with saying I am not a scientist, and neither are most of my audience. I think it is incumbent on us to understand these discoveries and where medicine and science is going. And I love how you make this material very accessible to people. But your work focuses on regulatory T cells, which are kind of the immune system brakes. We'll get into some other analogies later. And the hope is that if we can harness these cells for autoimmune disease, we can go from treating the symptoms of things like arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, and MS, to actually addressing the imbalance that creates them in the first place. So I want you to take that little description and make it way better. What is the implication of this work? Why is it so important? And what should we be looking for in it?
Well, I think the description is really quite apt. I'm not sure I need to make it any better. It's conceptually not that difficult. So we have, as humans, have developed an immune system that's come about over thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. And it's designed to protect us from pathogens. Bugs, worms, viruses, all sorts of things. And it does a pretty good job. I mean, we get the occasional cold and whatever. But in general, it clears up and it's done a great job. A consequence of that is that our immune system has to be able to see an enormous number of potential things attacking us. And as anyone who gets a flu virus every year realizes, it's the flu every year, but it's different enough that our immune system needs to be reprogrammed and see it again. Because the flu is also saying, haha, I'm going to avoid you. And it mutates as well. It changes every single year so that it can perpetuate itself. And so there's this game of cat and mouse that our immune system has. What that means is that our immune system is incredibly diverse. It can see all sorts of things. And a consequence of that is sometimes it sees our own tissues. It'll see our own pancreas and we'll get type 1 diabetes. It'll see our own brain tissue and we'll get MS. It'll see our own colon tissue and you'll get inflammatory bowel disease, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's dozens of these. And that happens to somewhere between 5 and 10% of the population. So most people do not have these problems, but a significant number do. It's a small percentage, but it's a significant number. Therefore, the question for us had been, and still is to a large extent, why? Why do some people have this breakdown in their immune recognition so that it sees their own tissues and other people don't? And people have been working on this for generations. There was a Nobel Prize in 1960 around the concept of this and showing that this concept is true, but at that point, there weren't the tools and the knowledge and the depth to understand how. And so the award that just happened a few months ago was for three of us. And one of the recipients was a gentleman in Japan who identified a very small subset of cells in a mouse which controls this. And it was, I'm not going to say a phenomenon, but it was true, but it wasn't super easy to characterize and understand these cells. What Mary and I did was identify the gene, Mary, the gene, I, the function, of the thing that controls those cells. And we know from studies in both mice and humans that if you don't have this gene, you don't have these cells, and if you don't have these cells, you will die. You will die because the immune system attacks your own body. There are other mutations in which you don't have an immune system. You will also die. It's because pathogens attack you. Mm-hmm. So you have to have both sides of this equation to be healthy. And most of us do, but some of us don't. But the idea is really to, I hesitate to use the word, but I'm going to say reset the immune system. I don't actually want to reset it to zero. So I don't want to get rid of all your immunity to every virus you've ever seen and everything you've ever been immunized to. But I want to reset it in such a way that it will no longer react to your own tissues. So I saw a quote of mine somewhere where I said, I don't want to treat disease, we want to cure disease. And I thought, ooh. But you know what? That's true. And in fact, when we set up the company, we actually put that in our mission statement somewhere at one point. And it's aspirational. It's absolutely, if we get to where we're treating people and everyone's doing great, that's okay. Yeah. But ultimately, I think cure is the right term, and we can do it in cancer, in some people, in some cancers. So I don't think it's inconceivable at this point. Is it going to happen by the end of 2026? It will not. But will it happen in my lifetime? Maybe, depending how long I live. But maybe that's not impossible. So I think that's where we're trying to get this ultimately to work, is to really understand how we can get people's immune systems to do what it's designed to do, keep us healthy from pathogens, but not attack us in the same time, in the same process.
I was telling you the story of my friend who had stage 4 cancer, had CAR T treatment, is cancer free.
Yeah.
And hopefully, knock on wood, will be that way for a very long time.
Yeah, I'll mention it to Carl June. He's a friend of mine and okay. Does it at UPenn. But there are a bunch of people like that. And again, some of that work to develop that began back in the 1980s. But there were a lot of people who brought together different technologies and different understandings about how to make that work. But it really began in the late 80s, early 90s. And it took until, I don't know what year, somebody's got approved. I'm going to say 2010, I think, before these actually became approved drugs. Now, we knew they were working before that. It takes a little while to get approved. But, you know, it's still 25, 30 years. And I don't see why autoimmunity will be faster. And in fact, I can easily see why it's going to take longer. Because most people don't die of rheumatoid arthritis. They don't die of psoriasis. They don't die of IBD. They're not good.
Yeah.
But they're not going to die in a 6 to 18 month time frame, whereas in oncology, they will. And so it's a bit easier to move things through clinical trials in such a devastating disease as cancer relative to doing it in autoimmunity. So it will take a while to get some of these therapies through that do no harm principle still applies. But I do think it's going to happen.
You said something really interesting in your talk this morning at the JPM Berkeley Healthcare Conference, which was that this discovery was made, but it wasn't evident how to turn it into a drug. And there was a lot of really great science and drama between the discovery and how might this actually become a therapy that could treat somebody. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, understanding what the gene responsible for this entire process is was great, and it is great, but it doesn't mean you can use it. So in the year 2000, I don't think anyone in their right mind would do gene therapy for common autoimmune diseases. I don't think FDA would even consider gene therapy for common autoimmune diseases in the year 2000. Cell therapy was just beginning to be applied to oncology. And again, we mentioned that oncology, it's, I'm going to say, a more acute need. And so it was a little bit easier, not to imply that it was easy because it wasn't, to do in oncology than it is in autoimmunity. And so part of that is frankly investors, like the people who are downstairs. You know, do they want to invest in something that is completely different from the way all other therapeutics have been developed and has an unclear path? It's a little bit more difficult for people to get behind that. But at the same time, the technologies weren't great. So it took a while to understand how to get these cells in humans. All the original work was done in mice, and it's actually pretty easy to find these cells in mice. But mice live in a cage, and they're not exposed to pathogens, and they're all inbred. And in between 2000 and 2025, we've learned how to make cells as a drug. We could grow them in the lab. Sure, it doesn't mean they're a drug. They have to be consistent. There's just a whole bunch of criteria you want to use if you're going to put something back into a person. So, you know, in those 20 years, we learned how to make these cells as a drug. We learned how to find them in the human, which wasn't trivial, but we learned how to do that. We learned how to genetically engineer them in a way that was reasonably efficient, at least efficient enough to make a drug. And so there's a bunch of technologies that have opened up the ability to do this. And those continue to develop, and this will get easier and better and faster over time. But the technological advances really enabled this discovery to then move into becoming a useful product.
Fascinating. It's so exciting to think that we're right at the threshold of what is possible, right?
With
that this is just the early innings, early stages. There'll be disappointments. There'll be things that are exciting.
Yeah.
But that
My analogy, sorry I cut you off. My analogy is that we're using that cell phone that people saw in the 1970s to look like a brick with an antenna on it.
Right.
That was ridiculous. And only really rich people would ever use that. And it was silly. Without that, we don't have iPhones in our pockets.
Yeah.
And so I don't know I'm hoping what we're doing right now isn't quite that bad, but it's certainly not the iPhone we have today. And this will continue to get better. As humans, we're really good at solving technological problems. Mm. If we know what the problem is historically, we're pretty good at figuring out an answer. And I'm pretty confident now that we know the problem in peripheral tolerance, that is the breakdown of our immune system recognizing our own tissues. Now we know what at least part of that problem is, we'll be able to engineer our way into a solution.
You did not attend UC Berkeley, but you did attend UCLA.
Berkeley rejected me, by the way, so I'll just point that out.
You said that straight to the chancellor this morning. He was nodding. Spent time at NIH, and then pretty early in your career chose the path of working in biotech, working in industry.
Correct.
And I thought it was an interesting discussion this morning that you brought forward to say, here's why I picked that. I picked that because it was exciting. It was where the really deep collaboration was happening. There weren't as many barriers to interdisciplinary work. Say more about that, because I think people think of academia as where the best, purest discovery happens. And I think what you were saying is, hold on a minute, there is this other path that looks different, and it can create kinds of advances that might be actually hard in academia. Say
yeah,
more about
it's
that.
True. I was looking at both academia and biotech when I was leading my postdoc. And I realized that my future colleagues at Immunex were as smart as anyone I would work with in academia. But I would work with them really closely. And these were people who could do things that I couldn't do or I would do poorly. And I could do things that they would do poorly. So when we put it all together on a particular project, we did really well. And I will say that in the early days of cloning genes, it was not academia that did most of that work. It was biotech. It was Immunex. It was Genentech. It was Biogen. It was Zymogenetics. There were half a dozen companies, and I'm forgetting two or three of them, I'm sure, who identified the cast of characters and were able to say, these are the players, and here's what some of them do. And so a number of them are now actually drugs in the clinic that treat various diseases and things. But it really was biotech doing a lot of that because they had industrialized the process. What would happen a lot in biotech is you would identify something, you would try to figure out what it did, you would come to a conclusion or do a set of studies or whatever and decide, yeah, that hypothesis was wrong. That doesn't do that, something. And so you might move on to something else. In academia, they might pound away at that for 10 years. And in year 10, they might go, here's what this does. And so it's a really good interaction that can happen. It doesn't, and it's not even a collaboration. It's really kind of the way the system is built.
It's almost more like a baton that's not exactly passed, but that moves from one team to another.
It's more like a hand grenade. You throw this out there, and someone in that world goes, huh, I know what that means. But the biotech and academic interplay has been, and I think continues to be, incredibly valuable for us as a society.
We're in a period of a lot of disruption of that. I'd be curious what you, if you were, you know, emperor of the world, what you'd be like, hold on a minute, guys, here's what we cannot disrupt. As we all know, it's disruption of the funding sources, it's disruption of public universities, FDA. Are you worried?
So here's my take, which is, am I worried about the acute problems around funding and how academia and the public sector interact right now, government enters. Of course, I'm worried about it. But I will say, having been doing this for, I don't know, 40 years now, there's been tough funding times before. There'll be tough funding times again in the future. What I think is fundamentally different today is there is a sentiment, not universal, but a much larger sentiment, at least in the United States, that science is not to be trusted. Medicine is not to be trusted. And to be fair, if you don't trust science, why would you fund it? That wouldn't make any sense. I don't want my money funding stuff I don't trust, so I don't think anybody else does. So that's understandable. The question is, how did we get to this lack of trust? And that's a challenge I think we need to work on. You know, it's easy to say, well, social media, whatever. But I think it's deeper than that. And so I do think that people need to have a dialogue. And I want to be careful I don't say people need to understand, because then I'm just preaching at people, and that never works very well, right? So you need to have a dialogue about why people don't trust things and what's not trustworthy. What's the expectation? If you think everything a scientist said is going to be right, well, that's on you. That's not true. So, but that doesn't mean science writ large is wrong. So we mentioned earlier, we can cure people of cancer today. I could not have said that 20 years ago. Not everybody, not all cancers, but we can do it today, which is a huge change from where we were. There are enormous numbers of advances in biomedical engineering, but it goes beyond that. We all have an iPhone. No science, no iPhone. No Sputnik, we don't have GPS. We don't have satellites that transmit our phone calls. I think we have to appreciate somehow that science has provided us the lives we have today. How do we have the dialogue and ensure that people are on the same page of what we want to do with it going forward? Because we need to get back to a place where, I won't say there's respect, but there's understanding of the goals of what we're trying to do. And I don't think we're there right now. And I'll give you a parenthetical analogy, which is just kind of silly. But being in Stockholm for the Nobel Prizes, I'm in a country where scientists are considered essentially rock stars almost. Motorcades with the lights going on and people standing on the sidewalks watching my car go by. It was crazy. I mean, this is something that I think culturally they have embedded and that they take very seriously. And so right now, the contrast between that and the U.S. is pretty significant. And I think one of my goals really is to try to figure out how do we get back to a point where we can actually talk about these things and come to some common understanding.
Mm. Where we saw a lot of the folks that were skeptical of vaccines were in diseases and conditions where people felt abandoned, where they felt like whether it was autism or even autoimmune, where there really hadn't been meaningful progress. Symptoms are often kind of not attended to or gaslit even. And so there have been these domains of health where the science has made progress, but not in a way that people really feel like they've been seen and heard.
Correct.
And so it's interesting to me that your discoveries are in one of those domains, because I think that's been true of a lot of autoimmune diseases.
Yeah.
So, I don't know where that puts us exactly, because we're still going to have mysteries. We're still going to have areas that we don't exactly know what to do. And it actually made me think about another aspect of your work that I find really interesting, which is, and I'll say this as a non-scientist, it's a more ecological way of thinking about the body. It's not trying to like hammer down problems as they come up. It's saying, how do we put this back in balance?
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you think that concept, that way of approaching medicine, has deeper implications for how we think about health and medicine.
I do. But I do think there's some implications there. And some of it is when people haven't seen, I would argue, truly meaningful change in some of these situations, I think there's a void. And I think a risk is that, I don't want to say fake science, but other non-proven theories take up the space. And I think that is a challenge. And obviously in today's world, information moves at the speed of light. But so does disinformation. So it's really difficult sometimes to separate what's actually reality versus what's perception. And so I think, as you pointed out, that it can be a challenge for consumers, non-scientists, to understand what's actually science and what's not science now. We need to be much better aligned than we are today, because the current situation, we will get through this, but not if it lasts for 20 years. I mean, we'll lose a generation or two. And that's a tragedy.
Is this one of the areas you want to focus on?
I do think it's important. Yeah, exactly. How to do that, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
But I do think it's really important, because we can afford to lose a generation, but I think that would be tragic. And, you know, as an American, you could take it nationalistically, because frankly, if the U.S. has been by far the most innovative country for the last 50 years in, again, biomedical research, you could expand that, I'm sure, but I'm not going to try. But if we're not going to do it, someone else is. I mean, there are plenty of smart people around this planet, and they'll take over. And so if you want an economic argument, I'd hate to lose the economics of that, which is billions and billions of dollars, to other countries. Now, I think it's great that innovation should come from everywhere. I don't have a problem with other people being innovative.
But competition is good.
Right, but competition is good. And I think it all boats rise. And I would hate to see us not continue to lead that field.
Mm. Well said. Your path is quite remarkable in that you started in community college, which many kids in California do. What more do we need you to make sure that the avenue of possibility is open for every kid that is coming up?
So I actually don't know that I think that system is terribly broken, to be honest. Mm. I think, so I've been out of California for a long time and I've been out of the educational system for a long time. So my opinion on this is probably not worth very much. But I do think that the tiered system that California had established of community colleges, the state schools, and the UCs actually provided opportunity for a lot of people. Now, does everyone have the financial resources to get through that? Maybe, maybe not. Oh, I'm sure the answer is no. But what's the fraction? It's probably big if you want to go through that kind of route, which it worked for me, right? I took out loans. Now, they were smaller loans and it wasn't a big deal. And I was never burdened by my loan. And I know people are today. So I know it's different, but I don't think it's terrible. What I actually worry more about is representation of, this is a bad word, diversity of thought and perspective in some of these fields. I mean, biomedical research, I can't tell you how many African-American people I've worked with. I should be able to tell you because I can probably count it on two hands. It's very small. It's a very small fraction. I don't understand the genesis of that, but I don't think it's good. I think perspective is really important. I think women's representation is really quite high, although I don't think it's as high as it needs to be at the upper levels of some of these organizations. So I'm worried more about getting the diversity of opinion and perspective and just thought processes into this than I do about mass. I don't know that we need more people. I think we need additional variety of people.
Mm.
So I'm less worried about getting more people into college and through college and through STEM than I am making sure that the people who typically aren't into that have that opportunity. Mm. You can't force people to go into STEM, but they have that opportunity. Mm. And I don't know that that's true.
You've often said that, which I think is true of all of us if we're going to be honest, that you are often wrong. Tell us about a time when being wrong led to something truly remarkable.
Well, my prioritization of the genes that got us the
right?
Nobel Prize is certainly right. One of those.
So if I remember right, there were 20 options.
Yeah.
The one that ended up being correct was the last one you had prioritized.
Right, and I prioritized it last because it was my least favorite choice. And for I had very logical reasons for why I prioritized it last, and it turned out to be the most important thing that I ever did in science. Great. So I was completely wrong in the way I prioritized it. Okay. But there's a lot of examples where, you know, I had a hypothesis about something being the cause of something, and it wasn't. But that doesn't mean along the way you didn't learn something else about that process. And so I think that's incumbent on anyone who's a decent scientist is you follow the data. You have a hypothesis. You think this is how it works. You test it. Huh, that's not how it worked. But I learned this, so that's okay. And as long as you keep doing that, it's fine. You know, you can get in trouble when you try to force the data to fit your hypotheses. Then that doesn't work very well at the end of the day. But there's a lot of times where we tried to do things and it didn't work. The company I started with, where we did the FOXP3 and the cloning of this gene and figured all this out, that company, the entire original premise of that company, which was to treat autoimmune diseases, turned out to be wrong. And it wasn't my hypothesis to begin with. I somewhat inherited it, but it was fine. We tested it and turned out to be wrong. And I had to go to the board, and the scientific board in particular, and tell them we're going to stop working on this because it didn't work. It didn't make sense. And I had one of our senior scientific advisors tell me I'd walked to the brink of greatness and turned away. And I just looked at him and as a slightly obnoxious 30-year-old at this point or something, and I just said, I think I walked to the edge of a cliff and avoided falling off and dying. Get out of my office. You know, this is our company, not yours. You're an advisor. Thank you very much. But you can't be afraid of being right and wrong all the time when you're doing this. If you are, you'll never make any progress.
So you're on this interesting new threshold where you are no longer with the company in a day-to-day way. What are two or three things you want to be spending time on in the next 6 months?
So some of this is science education, for sure. There are a number of other organizations, companies, nonprofits that have reached out, not surprisingly. Some of them are actually pretty interesting and very, very forward-looking, very long-term. And I'm kind of intrigued with what the potential is of some of those. And so the ability to advise and guide or at least provide perspective to some of them is intriguing to me. I don't want to spend, you know, my entire life doing that. But there's an interesting aspect of winning a Nobel, which is there's a lot of functions that the foundation puts on and appendant foundations put on to have dialogue about various aspects of whether it's science and technology or just culture, et cetera, kind of intrigued with those functions. So I'll be exploring some of those over the next couple of years as well.
And what about the dogs, the camping?
Oh, those are all going to still happen. Okay. My phone will still be on. Someone said, are you going to leave your phone on? I'm like, no. Someone else said, get a satellite phone. I'm like, I don't want a satellite phone. No, I'm not a pediatric neurosurgeon. No one will die if I don't answer my phone. It's okay. No, I don't. No. So I will absolutely still do that. I will spend a lot of time skiing and hiking and snowshoeing and biking and all the other stuff that I do. But this year is going to be a lot more on the road, which is, you know, I'll get to see old friends and new places. Yeah. And so I am not complaining in the slightest bit. No one can complain about this. If you complain about this,
you have other problems.
You need a psychiatrist.
Anything else you want to share before we sign off?
This is a great journey. This is another part of it. And I probably still won't listen to this podcast, but
I'm okay because this is your first. So I get to say first ever. I'm going to have to check that first.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's true. It may or may not be true.
I will check to see. But in any case, one of your firsts.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
My husband works in regenerative agriculture, where a really exciting transformation is taking place. Attention has shifted from mechanistic farming, you know, see a bug, spray pesticides, to a more ecological approach focused on balance and interdependence. If you've read Omnivore's Dilemma or Braiding Sweetgrass, you know what I mean. And what I love about Fred's work is that it brings a similar frame to health. Instead of playing whack-a-mole with symptoms, suppressing flare-ups, tamping down inflammation, managing downstream damage, it asks, what would it look like to restore balance? We can keep treating symptoms in our bodies, in our healthcare system, or we can build the conditions for balance and health. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Fred Ramsdell and his Nobel Prize-winning work on T cells and the immune system. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.